Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue this morning. This is a scheduled day off for him. Do not fear. He, as far as I know, is fine. And we'll be back on Monday. I'm joined this morning for the Roundtable panel by former EPA Regional Administrator, President of Beyond Plastics, and faculty member at Bennington College, Judith Enck. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. Great to be with you.
Also in studio this morning, diplomat in residence at Bard College, Fred Hoff. Hiya, Fred.
Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Ready for a weekend.
You
and
bet.
Albany County District Attorney David Soares is here. Hi, David.
I feel like I haven't done my homework. I'm on with two professors, so I'm a little intimidated.
It's a recurring nightmare, right? That's my worst dream I always have, is that I'm still in school and I don't know what
absolutely.
My schedule is.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. So, and I'm like,
you're going to pass, David. Everyone holds off till the end of the semester anyway.
Yeah, really is kind of a pass-fail thing, I think, also. Before we discuss the news of the day, we want to do a little plugs section that I didn't warn you guys about in studio, but you'll listen to me and Judith, and if you have anything to mention after, then you'll know what to do. Judith, I'm going to start with my plug, and then you can do yours, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the music we're listening to this morning is by Rhiannon Giddens, who's playing the Fresh Grass Festival on Sunday. That's at Mass MoCA.
Oh,
she's an
nice.
Amazing musician. I mean, out of this world, unbelievably talented, old music, new music musician. She put out her first album of original songs recently. It's called You're the One, and that is the music we're listening to this morning. Another
that's some
thing
good stuff.
Is,
that was
so
good.
I was gonna say you should get into Rhiannon Giddens. I think you'll really dig.
Miss Giddens.
Yeah, she's. I mean, out of this world, unbelievably good. Another unbelievable musician performing at Fresh Grass is a musician named Aoife O'Donovan, who is premiering some new commissioned work. She's done a song cycle inspired by letters between suffragist Carrie Chapman Catt and President Woodrow Wilson around the suffrage movement succeeding, women getting mm-hmm. the vote. She's written a five song cycle about that she's performing tomorrow at Fresh Grass, along with some other new music. And after that, I'm doing a Q&A with her on stage about the music. And I'm incredibly excited. I've been listening to it at an old stream of it, and I just can't believe how inspiring and beautiful the work is. So if you're able to attend Fresh Grass, I recommend it, but also keep an eye on it. Otherwise, it is going to be an incredible project.
Well, you mentioned Fresh Grass, and obviously my mind went elsewhere.
Yes, cannabis.
yes. But, you know, it's amazing, and I'm really happy that you're, you know, plugging and talking about these artists, because, you know, if you're like me and what you get to hear every day of things like on the radio, it just becomes stale. It's can be so uninspiring. And so when you mention someone who's actually writing songs, you know, about women's suffrage and taking on that period of time, it's an opportunity to both enjoy it artistically, but also learn.
It's truly beautiful. She's a folk musician, but these songs are orchestrated with a small classical ensemble, and it's just gorgeous, gorgeous stuff. That's Fresh Grass, freshgrass.com. Judith, you have an event tomorrow as well.
Yeah, so much going on locally. So tonight actually kicks off the New York Writers Institute Book Festival.
That's right.
Yeah, tonight at 7:30, there will be the award of the state author to Jacqueline Woodson and the new state poet, Patricia Spears Jones. And then most of the book festival happens tomorrow, Saturday, at SUNY Albany between 10:30 and 5. And I am really honored to be interviewing Annie Prue, You know some of her books. She wrote Brokeback Mountain. That was actually an article in The New Yorker that was turned into a movie. Her current book that I'm all over is it's about peatland destruction and its role in climate change. It's called Fen, Bog, and Swamp. And I'm a little nervous because I've never, I mean, Sarah, you and Joe do this all the time. I'm usually on the other side. So I've got all these notes. I will be interviewing Annie Prue, who is just a literary giant. And I love talking about wetlands and bogs. So that should be good. And then, and people can go to the New York State Writers Institute. It's nyswritersinstitute.org.
Mm-hmm. Or albanybookfestival.com. And I do want to tell you, Judith, that Joe and I do, Joe does things like this all the time. I do them sometimes. And we are both also always a little bit nervous. So that's part of it. Don't worry.
Yeah, that's good.
Or try not to.
That's good. I'll just take the advice I give everyone else to breathe deeply. The other quick thing, also really fun. Next Sunday, October 1st, there'll be this great event in Manchester, Vermont. Basically, we're gathering to talk about this amazing new book by Eve Schaub,
mm-hmm.
called
A Year of No Garbage. Sorry for talking over you. She's a former Roundtable listener essayist. She used to write essays for the Roundtable. It's a segment we no longer do, but when we did, she was one of them.
She's great. She's
yes.
very factual and very funny.
Mm-hmm.
She took my online class on plastic pollution at Bennington College and wrote this beautiful book and, you know, kind of dedicated it to Beyond Plastics. So it's going to be Eve, who is the star. Joe Donahue is the moderator. And then Bill McKibben and me. So I'm more comfortable being on the other side of the table. So that's Sunday, October 1st at 2 o'clock. Beautiful foliage will be in Manchester, Vermont, and tickets through Northshire Books. It's at the Southern Vermont Arts Center, or go to beyondplastics.org for cheap tickets.
So that is an event at the Albany Book Festival tomorrow, albanybookfestival.com. The event in Manchester, October 1st, tickets through Northshire. And Fresh Grass is at Mass MoCA all weekend, freshgrass.com. Do you guys have any events or symposia you'd like to mention?
No, I would just say that these are two marvelous plugs, and thanks for taking the time to do it. You know, my wife Brenda and I moved up from the Washington, D.C. area 6 years ago to the Mid-Hudson Valley, and we've been consistently stunned by the depth of the art scene, not only in upstate New York, but in neighboring states, you know, Western Mass, Vermont, Connecticut. It's amazing.
Well, I would like to plug Huggies.
I was going to say, you don't have time to do anything because you've got
a
new baby.
And also Tide.
I don't know if we're allowed to plug Tide.
David Soares' new novel, A Date with Dirty Laundry, and a lot of dishes.
Your big main event is, well, you have a very important job, of course, but also you're parenting a two-year-old and a four-week-old, co-parenting with your wife.
Yes, my wife would give it a different label, but yes, I'm definitely co-parenting, co-producer, co-executive of...
maybe assistant.
Assistant.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for all of that. We'll post some links with the roundtable post on WAMC.org this morning. Let us talk briefly before the break. I didn't send this to you guys, but I'm sure you all know a little bit about it. We just want to mention it because it's huge news and it's so devastating. We want to talk about it a little and send out our well wishes. There was a big bus crash in Orange County. Two adults were killed and multiple students were injured after their bus tumbled down a 50-foot ravine Thursday on Interstate 84 in Orange County, New York. Governor Hochul said in an evening news conference, the commercial bus was carrying 40 students from Farmingdale High School and four adults on their way to a band camp event in Pennsylvania. And we just wanted to, you know, mention it since it is local, regional, and national news, and a tragedy. And I didn't want to go without mentioning it, but I also didn't know how much we should discuss about it with news, you know, details still coming out. And it's not really an analytical kind of event. But if you guys have anything to
Yeah, there are details still coming out, but you know, one thing is for sure, and that is the loss being felt by at least two families, the two adults who were killed, and the intensive trauma felt by the other kids and their families, and not just the kids who were in the affected bus. I mean, this applies to everyone. So it's you know, it's a very sad event, indeed.
Yeah, you know, obviously because of my work, I'm around a lot of tragedy. There is something so different about vehicular-related crashes. That's just very different. That kind of loss is very different. It's so unexpected. It's almost like lightning striking. And as you said, Fred, the loss isn't just with respect to the families of those who have lost someone, but the incredible trauma that everyone on that bus, the entire community of that school, those neighborhoods, it's a devastating, devastating loss. And I'm glad you mentioned it this morning,
yeah.
Sarah.
Judith, do you have anything to add? No pressure.
Well, you just think of the setting. These are a bunch of, I think, high school kids probably really excited on their way to band camp in Pennsylvania. And the two people that tragically died, one was, I think, the director of all the bands at the school, and then a retired social studies teacher in her mid-70s. And in my mind's eye, I can just kind of see the scene on that bus. You know, kids are excited, and they're going to be away at band camp. That's got to be a blast. And then this happens. And all I can say is condolences to the families that lost loved ones and to that whole community. It's going to take them a very long time through the grieving process. And I'm sure they'll get, you know, grief support from the school, but they're going to need a lot of support and a lot of time here.
WAMC will stay on the story, of course, and our reporters and news team will be on top of updating people as, you know, relevant public details are exposed. You can stay abreast at WAMC.org. And I am just going to be fully transparent in this moment. We have just a few minutes before the next break. I'm going to talk about the Roundtable Mug Design Contest, understanding that that is a very silly tonal shift, but I don't want to start a new story with just a few minutes left. So I hope that everybody will come along with me on that. As I mentioned, we are opening the lockbox at the beginning of October, and a new premium that we will offer during the fun drive that begins on October, in the middle of October, is a travel mug, a travel tumbler, a stainless steel mug with a design on it by a WAMC listener. So there is information about the Roundtable Mug Design Contest online at WAMC.org/RT Mug Contest. We have the submissions. I think we've been open for about two weeks now, and we've received maybe only in the teens of submissions. So we're hoping to up that ante, although right now, if you've already submitted, your chances of winning the contest are pretty good. There is information about the type of artwork that you may submit online at that website, wamc.org/RT Mug Contest. We are going to vote within the staff on the finalists, and then WAMC listeners will vote on the final winner, and that will be printed on a mug that we offer during our next fun drive. And go ahead, David.
My question is it just letters, or can it be artwork?
Artwork. It can be okay. Some kind of, I think, a six-color maximum.
Okay, so let me just ask.
Anything you want.
What color is the dumpster on the side of the building here?
I don't know why the question made me feel defensive.
Well, I mean, if I
but
were...
I'm just going to expose that it did. I don't know. I don't know.
If I
were
to submit... you know, cartoon rendering.
Oh,
of
I see.
Joe looking for his keys in the dump. I'd want to make sure that I.
That would be mean.
Well, Joe wears, sometimes he wears these multi-patterned
plaid shirts.
And so I want to make sure that I'm within the color Within those limitations. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know that you have time with your job and parenting, as we've discussed, to become an artist.
I'm tossing some ideas out there.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. The website again, wamc.org/RT Mug Contest. And I am going, now we still have a couple of minutes before we can take a break. So I'm going to start reading about the shutdown instead of, you know, scrounging.
I mean, there are other ideas we could do. I mean, I could do a rendering of Susan Collins and Senator Susan Collins and her friend Judith.
I know this is coming.
We could do another one of Ray Graff with his headset in that same look of bewilderment that he has. Those are all good, like, mug ideas.
I am wondering what people will come up with, if they will veer toward representing the on-air personalities or something more abstract, or I don't know. We don't have a logo for the roundtable because we haven't been able to think of what it should be. So that's part of the deal here.
Well, I
love that it's a reusable mug.
Of course. Of course. Yes, indeed. Hand wash, as most stainless steel travel tumblers tend to be, because they'll lose something if you put them in the dishwasher.
Well, seeing as how we have an audience that sometimes they, you know, very detail oriented. I mean, when you mispronounce a word, we're always corrected. I mean, I really want to be part of the team that just reviews the submissions, because there's going to be some interesting things there, I think.
The mug contest information is at wamc.org/RT Mug Contest. We are, Kaylin, I'm going to go to the break a little bit early so I don't start a story with 1 minute to go. Do you have a promo you could play for me? Thank you. All right, we will be back with the meat of the panel, the true news discussion that you came here for, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue this morning, joined for our panel discussion by Judith Enck, Fred Hoff, and David Soares. We are going to talk about a looming government shutdown, this from the AP, with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy's latest funding plan in ruins and lawmakers leaving town for the weekend. There's no endgame in sight as hard-right Republicans push dangerously closer to a disruptive federal shutdown. McCarthy has repeatedly tried to appease his hard-right flank by agreeing to the steep spending cuts they're demanding to keep government open. But cheered on by former President Trump, more on that later, the Republican frontrunner for president for 2024, the conservatives have all but seized control of the House. In a crushing defeat Thursday, a handful of Republican hardliners blocked a typically popular defense bill from advancing. The second time this week, it was set back, which is an unheard-of loss for a House Speaker. Even a stopgap bill to keep government funding past the September 30th deadline, called a continuing resolution, is a non-starter for some on the right flank. We need extreme MAGA Republicans to get their act together, said House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries of New York, referring to Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, of course. One of Trump's top allies, Rep. Matt Gaetz of Florida, who is leading the hard right flank, said the House Republicans now have almost no choices left but to spend the time it takes to pass each of the 12 bills needed to fund the government, typically a laborious process, even if it means going into a shutdown. Or they can join with Democrats to pass a continuing resolution, which is sure to put McCarthy's job at risk. What Gaetz has said, and several others, would not do is vote for a continuing resolution that fails to slash spending. The open revolt is further evidence that McCarthy's strategy of repeatedly giving in to the conservatives is seemingly only emboldening them, allowing them to run roughshod over their own House majority. Their conservative bills have almost no chance in the Senate. Fred.
Sometimes you have to wonder why Kevin McCarthy wants to hold on to this job. It's just one humiliation after another. But I must say he's bringing a good deal of it on himself. I mean, one thing that stuns me is, Kevin McCarthy is Speaker of the House. He is in command in the House. So with the prospect of the U.S. government being unable to pay wages to federal employees, unable to do all kinds of things fiscally, he lets the House of Representatives adjourn for a long weekend. I don't understand this. Stay in session. Work this out. Now, I guess a more positive side of things, if there is a so-called government shutdown on the 1st of October, it's not as potentially catastrophic as what could have happened last June, if the debt ceiling had not been increased. A shutdown that lasts a few days, even a couple of weeks, will not have a catastrophic effect on the economy. It'll have a lot of inconvenience for many people. Federal workers will not be paid. Uniformed military personnel will not be paid until the shutdown ends. People will be repaid retroactively. But this is a tremendous hardship, and all of this is entirely gratuitous. My own sense is that one way forward is something that is being discussed by a couple of New York State Republican congressmen, Lawler and Molinaro. And this is bringing forward a continuing resolution that would keep the government open, that would give Congress a chance to do its work, which is to legislate and appropriate. Okay, there are 12 appropriations bills that make up the U.S. federal budget. Only one has been passed. This is a situation that has gone on for decades under Democrats and Republicans in control of Congress. What conceivably could happen is a group of moderate Republicans will join with Democrats to offer a continuing resolution keeping the government in business, and even permitting Speaker McCarthy to keep his fingerprints off it, even permitting Speaker McCarthy to vote no on the continuing resolution. But presumably there would be enough votes, 214 or whatever, Democrats and a handful of Republicans to get this passed. So McCarthy could presumably vote no, and maybe hang on to his job. But just to bring things full circle, I'm beginning to wonder why he even wants to hang on to this job.
Right. Well, and I don't mean to sound naive, but it's so many games. Like, you're like, please take care of the country, and they're like, we have a lot of games to play first.
Yeah, and look, an agreement was reached in June between the Speaker and the President of the United States on fiscal year 2024 spending levels, $1.6 trillion. This agreement is in place. Now there is a small handful of House Republicans who are saying, no, we want to renege on that agreement. We want to drop to $1.4 trillion. And that's just a non-starter. But as the Speaker has said, these are about his own party members. These are people willing to torch the place, and I don't understand it.
Judith?
Oh, I understand it. It's Speaker Matt Gaetz is the very poorly informed and not working in the public interest Congress member from Florida. He is really taking control of the House, and it's a problem that that the House is controlled by Republicans narrowly. We kind of saw this coming when it took 15 votes for McCarthy to be voted Speaker. And I'm not as optimistic that this is going to be resolved in any useful way. I mean, there is a local angle here. What Matt Gaetz is now pushing is he's very much against continuing resolutions. And he says he just assumes there's going to be a government shutdown. It's inevitable. So he wants, as Fred described, he wants to bring a series of different GOP-drafted appropriation bills to the floor, but he knows that that's not going to prevent a shutdown. Politico nationally has a story today on this, and it includes the following information. Matt Gaetz has a surprising partner in this plan, Representative Mark Molinaro, a New York moderate who is one of the 18 House Republicans representing a district carried by Joe Biden. Molinaro has been involved in various attempts to solve the shutdown crisis this week, including the bipartisan effort to use a discharge petition to force a vote on a continuing resolution. However, he's also working with Matt
Gaetz.
Yeah, he's working with Matt Gaetz on a plan to kill the continuing resolution. So, you know, one thing that says to me is, journalists, note to self, stop referring to Mark Molinaro as a moderate. He's not. He's the sidekick of Matt Gaetz now at a really important moment in Washington. I mean, it's amazing. We're just over a week away. My great concern, because the Republicans in the House are in such disarray, my great concern is that they're going to, you know, they're not going to reach agreement. We'll have a shutdown that can last a really long time. I mean, there have been a lot of shutdowns, way too many. There have been 20 federal government shutdowns since 1976. The longest was 35 days during the Trump administration. The average government shutdown is 8 days. And I can tell you, the federal government is, you know, you can't just flip a switch and say, okay, we're shutting down tomorrow. Federal agencies are spending all of their time today planning for the shutdown. I was at EPA during the Obama administration in 2013 when we had a 16-day shutdown. And what that involves is, as Fred mentioned, most federal employees are furloughed, meaning you can't do any work whatsoever. And there's real anxiety because traditionally when the furlough period ends, federal employees will get back pay. But you have a number of federal staff who are living paycheck to paycheck, important administrative support people, who can't, you know, miss a couple paychecks. And then there's always the unknown. Will they really get retroactive pay? Members of Congress, by the way, continue to get paid. A lot of people won't notice it because mail delivery is not affected. You know, the classic example is national parks and monuments are shut down, but it really causes tremendous disruption, and it costs the federal government a lot of money. There are some economic impacts, and also it really diminishes our standing in the world that the House of Representatives has been reduced to this. But here's the big worry. Matt Gaetz and his very small but influential crowd in the House is running the show today, and it's not going to end well.
I want to ask you all why, when there's no chance for the bills to pass in the Senate, why you think they bother. But first, we'll take a break, and then we will hear David's thoughts and mull over that question of mine. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc in for Joe Donahue this morning. Our panelists are Judith Enck, Fred Hoff, and David Soares, and we are discussing the very real specter of a shutdown that is before us. David Soares.
Yeah. Well, I think all of the best points have been made by Judith and Fred here.
Talk right into that microphone, would
sorry.
You?
Thank sorry. Thank you. But your question, of course, which I think is one of the most important questions, is, well, what's the point of all of this when you have a Democratic majority Senate, you have a Democratic president that will never, be on board with anything that this the suicide squad of of a caucus led by Matt Gaetz and his other friends would look to pass. You don't get to control the government of the United States with the numbers within that caucus. You don't get to dictate cuts to spending when you have the other two parties that are necessary in order to make those cuts a reality. You don't get to do that. So then the question is, well, what's the motive here? The motive here is simply, hey, I'm not really doing this job to help people. I'm here to raise money for myself and to be viewed. I mean, track this, right? Track every single statement that's being made by someone like Matt Gaetz and his caucus, and then track the amount of fundraising materials that are going out, you know, from their campaign offices. And the sad and perverse part is they're going to be rewarded for it because that's who they appeal to. And there is a culture that enables them. Now, as far as I think the politics, you are so right on, Fred. What's different about this shutdown, and previous talks, is the fact that the vast majority of the criticisms are coming from moderate Republicans. I think I heard one from Hakeem Jeffries, but the vast majority of public condemnation is coming from members of the Republican Party that want to get this done because they can appreciate the consequences, both politically, but also the impact on people's lives. Again, Judith mentioned the number of military personnel who won't, you know, be cashing in a paycheck. The contractors, as you said, Judith, you know, the federal employees, they get back pay for however long the government is shut down. But independent contractors, who there are many of, they won't be receiving, you know, those rewards. I think the only way out for the speaker is to present an opportunity like much of what you discussed. It's to have a group of moderate Republicans working together with the Democrats, bringing some resolutions to the floor and having those resolutions passed in that way. And then McCarthy saying he had nothing, you know, to do with it, no fingerprints of his involved, although he will be caught in a hot mic or something else that is in tradition of being Mr. McCarthy. He can't help himself but do this. But you're going to see that party implode within this next week.
Yeah,
I think go ahead, Fred. Sorry.
No, please, Judith, after you.
So I think David puts his finger on it. There is a way out of here. We just need a handful of moderate Democrats to vote. I'm sorry, moderate Republicans to vote with the Democratic majority, assuming you get all of the Democrats together. And, you know, they can negotiate a bill with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. But anticipating that, a lot of the more strident, uninformed MAGA crowd in the House has already said, if the scenario, which is so logical that David outlined, if that happens, Trump and others will go after the moderate Republicans who team up with Democrats to pass a reasonable budget. And so these so-called moderate Republicans have to decide, are they going to, you know, do what's right and keep the country running, kind of a big deal, or are they going to stand down because they're worried about Trump and MAGA going after them? And I just want to make one more point. There are some really legitimate fiscal concerns here. There is a lot of waste in federal government, but you don't hear, you know, fiscal conservatives saying, I'm going to vote this way because this program is bloated or this program is unaccountable. This is just all performative politics. As David said, they want to get on Fox News. They don't really care what the impact is on everyday Americans. They just want to get on Fox and they want to curry favor with Trump. And Trump is actively promoting this. So on a certain level, I want to amend what I said earlier about the power of Matt Gaetz. The power here really rests with Lawler and Molinaro and other Republicans who really need to be the adults in the room and literally work with Democrats to reach an agreement with the Senate and get the government not to shut down.
Panel at WAMC.org is the email address you may use to join the conversation. Jan wrote it and said, no one has yet mentioned that this so-called small contingent with Matt Gaetz at the nominal helm is in fact being orchestrated by the strawberry blonde, 215-pound, 91-count federal indictments record holder and puppet master Donald J. Trump. We also hear from John, who says the end game of the Republicans is to destroy the administrative state. People need to know that the federal government protects workers' rights, workers' safety, transportation safety, the protection of our investments in the stock market, the quality of our air and water, and many other parts of our life. Maybe if voters can figure this all out, they'll vote for politicians who will be responsible.
Yeah, I'm not so sure I'd paint the entire Republican Party with a broad brush here. But look, even for centrist Republicans, and let's just say for the sake of argument, this includes people like Molinaro and Lawler, they've got a real problem. I don't know the details of what Mark Molinaro is doing with Gaetz and all of this, but here's the problem. In order to prevail in general elections in districts that have a lot of Democrats, these Republicans have to be seen as doing their jobs in Congress seriously. They have to be legislating. They have to be operating on a bipartisan basis whenever they can. But doing those things also puts them in danger of being primaried, okay? By MAGA Republicans. Yeah. I can almost guarantee that if Lawler and Molinaro play a role with Democrats in bringing forward a continuing resolution, they will be primaried, and Donald Trump will be a driving force behind that.
Well, if you had a good speaker, right, or a good leader, you're not asking, you know, any of your members who are in, you know, contentious districts to put themselves at risk. What you're doing is you're looking around the entire congressional district map, and you're finding, hey, here's the congressman who represents one of the largest naval bases, you know, in the country, or one or those people who are ultimately going to be impacted on a daily basis by government shutdowns. You identify those areas, and those are the individuals that you begin to engage. Because trust me, if you're a service member, you are going to be feeling the pain of a government shutdown more so than anyone in this room. And the first person I'm calling is the office of my congressman to ask him why I can't pay my electricity bill.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was an Army officer, even as an officer, I was living paycheck to paycheck. And I think for most members of the uniformed services, this continues to be the case.
Yeah, this is hurting Republicans as well, which is the reason why I think many of these other elected congressmen have been so vocally critical of what's happening.
And this is why the administration, incidentally, is not driving the train right now in terms of trying to find a solution, because frankly, the administration, to a certain extent, is enjoying what the Republican Party is doing to itself in front of the American citizenry.
Russ writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, you know, it's only a small minority of voters that want the government to shut down. But because of the way in which legislation is brought to the floor, the minority will get their way. There is something wrong with this picture. Claire writes in and says, what's the motive? Just like Tuberville in the Senate, the motive is power. Look what we can do, and what are you going to do about it? We will end this topic in a minute. Judith, do you have anything you want to button it up with? Judith? Smooth.
Let me jump in on something Judith said, because I think it's a key point. There is a crucial minority in the House of Representatives that is there to perform. Period. No interest whatsoever in legislating. And who's at fault? The people who put them there.
Well, and the other thing that I think we should also be reminded of is the fact that our Constitution, the structure of our government, so much that is involved is the fact that you expect people to act in good faith. So we're not writing down every single thing because I think, you know, those who constructed our Constitution could not have foreseen, oh, that we would elect, you know, a senator who is going to attempt to leverage one political issue on the passage of a budget or the promotional process of an institution. Who could have foreseen that? But you have players, you know, the members of our theater, of our political theater, who are not in government to further our nation.
Yeah.
Panel at WAMC.org. It is time for a newscast with Mr. Ray Graff. The panel this morning, Judith Enk, Fred Hoff, David Soares. Information about the Roundtable Mug Design Contest is at WAMC.org/RT Mug Contest. We will switch to a new topic after this newscast. We'll be back after this. You're listening to The Roundtable.
There's a place I go when I want to get away from the crowded streets and the long work days. The women are nice and the men are pretty, because I just want to get out of this city. It's a little bitty joint just out of town. Got the best fried chicken for miles around. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go way over yonder. Down in the hollow. If I lead, will you follow? I'll take you way over yonder.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. That's Rhiannon Giddens singing a song from her album, You're the One, that song entitled Way Over Yonder. She's playing the Fresh Grass Festival at Mass Mocha in North Adams, Massachusetts this Sunday. The festival starts today and runs through Sunday, freshgrass.com. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org. The panelists today, former EPA regional administrator, president of Beyond Plastics, and faculty member of Bennington College, Judith Enk, diplomat in residence at Bard College, Frederick Hoff, and Albany County District Attorney David Soares. For the last segment of the show this morning, we're going to have a Climate March recap and a recycling seminar, primarily led by Ms. Judith Enk. The Climate March in New York City last weekend, tens of thousands of people, young and old, filled the streets of Midtown Manhattan under blazing sunshine on Sunday to demand that world leaders quickly pivot away from fossil fuels that are dangerously heating the earth. Judith was there and will tell us more. Judith.
I will, but Sarah, first, didn't you get married at Mass Mocha?
I did. Six years ago. It was a good time. We had a great party. Thank you.
Sure. So this past week, the United Nations General Assembly was meeting in Manhattan, and on September 20th, the UN Climate Ambition Summit was meeting. Thus, the timing of this gigantic march to end fossil fuels, which happened last Sunday, September 17th, my sister Helen Hogan's birthday. Sorry I missed the birthday, sis. But it was so wonderful being with about 70,000 people marching against fossil fuels. This was one of the largest demonstrations urging President Biden to stop supporting fossil fuel projects since he took office. There were a lot of people from the Capital District, the Hudson Valley, Vermont, Western Massachusetts. It was Old Home Week to some degree. We had about 200 people from Beyond Plastics marching together. One of our signs made it on the front page of the New York Times. And it was really significant. I think it's creating some momentum. Prior to the march, President Biden, after sadly approving the Willow drilling project in Alaska, he announced the week before the march that there would be no more oil and gas drilling on public lands, including in federal waters. That was good. And then 2 days ago, President Biden announced the establishment of a U.S. climate corps to train young people on renewable energy and energy efficiency skills. But for me, this march was different. I mean, I've been to many marches. I marched against the Iraq War. I've been to all the Earth Day events. This one felt different to me. It felt like there's momentum. Someone asked me, you know, was the crowd angry? No, there was actually a real sense of joy and fellowship in the crowd. But while I was marching, I just kept thinking about this past summer and what is at stake. The climate crisis is here. No one can really ignore the flooding, the more intense hurricanes, the incredible heat, the wildfire smoke. And so I'm just really feeling the pressure, and I think a lot of people are, and I wish members of Congress would stop this performative politics on whether or not to keep the federal government funded. And yes, definitely do your job and do that. But we have to do something to drive down greenhouse gas emissions. And that means no more fossil fuels, no more drilling, no more building pipelines and power plants that once they're built, they're going to be online for 40 or 50 years. It's really good to build wind and solar and geothermal, but a lot of that economic development gets canceled out if you're still burning coal and oil and gas. So that was the call of this march to end fossil fuels. And the longer we wait, the harder it is going to be. You know, the big unknown now is how do you keep the momentum going? There are a lot of groups working at the local level, but can they kind of climb the political ladder and get attention from state lawmakers, the governor, members of Congress, and the Biden administration to not just kind of nibble around the edges, but really get serious about the climate crisis?
Judith?
Yes?
I'm going to hire you right now to be an advisor for President Joe Biden. I'm going to hit you with this scenario, and I'd like for you to just properly advise President Joe Biden and also, you know, leaders within the Democratic Party. So you've got marches and protests going on in two different parts of our country right now. Two different parts of our country, although they appear to be entirely different, there is a common thread that almost pits one against the other. So in New York City, you have this climate march, and you're of course the ask is let's stop relying on fossil fuels for all the reasons that you just mentioned, and you know the science, it's not even questionable at this point. It's just a matter of fact. In the other state, you have the UAW right now that is on strike, and there is an environmental, you know, issue that is involved in there as well, in the sense that a lot of our manufacturers, who I think we've all recognized and applauded, have really pivoted strongly towards electric cars. And that bodes very well for all of the promises about lowering emissions in the United States. I think that, I don't know if it was 2036, but the goals that were set looks very promising that we could achieve those goals. However, electric cars are not cars that are preferred by at least the article indicates that the UAW has issues with those vehicles. They prefer the combustion engine because there's more labor involved in the combustion engine. Thus far, there's no control over battery manufacturers and they're non-union. And so you have that big issue. It would appear to me that if you're the president of the United States and you have a party that has a strong interest in lowering emissions and being a much greener country, but then on this other side where you are a pro-union Democrat. You're seeing all of this play out. How would you advise the President of the United States?
Well, this is a real opportunity for President Biden to exhibit continued leadership. He has a really warm and close relationship with the UAW and many labor unions, although you see Trump trying to, you know, create this division. I don't think the division is that pronounced. The combustion engine, you know, in 20 years is going to be like the horse and buggy. We have to electrify everything, and there should be good-paying union jobs to do it. Smart auto companies are shifting more and more to electric vehicles. Of course, workers should be paid a living wage with health care, but I think there's more in common with the United Auto Workers and the environmental community than divides them. And I think it's a leadership moment. I think in the strike, you know, that I've kind of noticed the electric vehicle wedge issue emerging. I think that's kind of orchestrated. I think that this really is a moment for Biden to bring both sides together. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's that difficult. A lot of, you know, a number of years ago, the only people making electric cars were Tesla and a couple little runs with the majors. But we're seeing just tremendous innovation, and not just electric cars, but electric trucks, electrifying shipping. You know, unions, I think, recognize this is the future, and I think they can negotiate agreements with or without leadership from Biden with the environmental community that these should be good-paying union jobs. And this is part of what we in the biz call just transition. I think a mistake that was made during the Obama administration is there was an understandable big focus on driving down greenhouse gas emissions, but not enough engagement and planning on what do you do when people working in coal mines lose their jobs. I think the Biden administration is taking a much more comprehensive approach to the issue of job replacement.
Right. Yeah, Judith, I have a related question. You know, based on the fact that you have a record of distinguished public service in the EPA. If you were somehow drafted into the Biden administration, perhaps in a White House advisory role on these issues, are there specific programmatic things you would recommend for the president to undertake? Are there specific legislative initiatives that would address the issues raised in these various protests?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would do is bring the protesters into the White House and talk to them, especially the young people. There is something going on that I don't think the Democratic Party recognizes, and that is a huge number of voters in their age 20s and 30s really rank the climate crisis as one of their top issues. And it's understandable. And it's not enough just for the president or his representatives to go on an occasional cute podcast. You have to bring people to the table. And more than young people that are rightly concerned about their future, there are large numbers of people living in frontline communities that are breathing in the pollution from the coal plants, from the from oil manufacturing, from plastic production. And they're the ones living with the implications of approving a pipeline or a power plant. And I want those voices at the table to define policy. And that's the first thing I would do. Not everyone gets everything, but you have to put public health first. And I think the Biden administration needs to be more realistic about the fact that the, you know, climate crisis is not something that's 10 years away. It's here now, and it's costing a lot of money. You know, just ask FEMA, who's already run out of their emergency money. So, you know, there are comprehensive legislative agendas. Senator Markey from Massachusetts is a leader. Senator Whitehouse. We have to be laser focused on not just promoting the clean energy economy, but also stopping to burn fossil fuels. You know, if your house is burning down, you have to take bold action. And I remember President Obama being, you know, criticized, you know, by his comments about the planet warming. But, you know, you live in Arizona and you've had, you know, over a month straight of 110 degrees and higher, putting more demands on the electrical grid to run air conditioning. You know, we're in a crisis.
I I'm inclined to agree with every single word you've said. But as a veteran of government myself, I realize that to govern is to choose, and mm-hmm. and often it's a matter of choosing between bad and worse. Stopping the use of fossil fuels, you know. I totally agree, but how does this translate mm-hmm. programmatically? Well, how does it translate legislatively? What if you were able to bring people into the White House, what would they be asking President Biden to do substantively about
sure.
this?
Sure. Well, and there is the added problem of the U.S. House of Representatives, and even, you know, some senators like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are not going to go along. So I think what Biden and Kamala Harris need to do is really emphasize their authority as executives. So you can do executive orders. You can also sit down with the head of the EPA, Michael Regan, who has spoken beautifully about the issue of environmental justice and the fact that it's low-income communities and communities of color that are carrying a disproportionate burden of pollution. So, Michael Regan, your agency issues permits for pipelines and gas plants and oil facilities. You have the authority to tighten those permits or reject them. So communities are not being poisoned. And then, you know, you bring in Department of Energy and say, if we're not going to have oil, gas, and coal, do we have adequate supply? Because, you know, we have to heat homes in the winter. And the biggest increase in demand on electricity is actually air conditioning because our summers are so hot. But, you know, Biden controls a vast, large, sprawling federal enterprise of all of these agencies. Agriculture, huge impacts on climate. Take the scientists from NOAA and have some real sobering conversations. And NASA, you know, what is the next, not just 20 years looking like, what are the next 2-3 years looking like? How do we shore up infrastructure? All of this can create jobs. And here's the thing, the Biden administration has really smart people working for them. They know how to do this. My former boss, Gina McCarthy, was the White House climate change advisor. She stepped down a few months ago. John Podesta is advising the president. I was a little disappointed in some of John Kerry's remarks. He leans too hard into advanced technological solutions. Yes, we have to improve battery storage, but relying on things like carbon capture and sequestration are just going to waste time and money. So, you know, Biden has some smart people, and he's got to make a judgment. Is this a serious priority for him or not? The IRA definitely helps a lot, but building more wind and solar and weatherizing homes is not going to be enough in terms of the mass volume of greenhouse gas emissions and the fact that what is emitted today lasts in the atmosphere for many decades. So we've got to turn the tap off now, not in 10 years.
Polly writes into panel at WAMC.org and says, following the recent climate exacerbated disasters in Maui and Greece, I could imagine how difficult it must be for those who live on islands to see their connection to the rest of the planet. We have to do a better job of convincing people that every single one of us is part of the problem and responsible for the solution, regardless of politics and turmoil. We need to come together. We also heard from John, who says, unfun fact. Last week, Australia hit temperatures that they usually only see in summer. It's early fall for them right now. To give you an equivalent, this would be like Florida and Texas hitting 100-degree highs on March 10th. That's what Australia is going through right now. Yes, this is here.
Australia was designed to kill people, whether it's frogs or venomous. I saw an article about a venomous sea snake. I'm like, really? Like, Australia.
There's always a new terrifying animal. That is the rule of Planet Earth that I have discovered by watching Planet Earth.
But their zip code is Australia. That's why I live in Glenmont.
And you know, on perhaps a less serious note, you know, if I were a Republican contender for the presidential nomination, running against Donald Trump, one of the themes I would center on, you know, speaking to people living in red states who have endured, you know, just an unbelievably brutal summer, people who are increasingly not skeptical about climate change as it affects their own lives. The argument I'd be making as an opponent to Donald Trump, as a Republican opponent, was, can we afford to take another 4-year vacation from addressing these problems? I have not heard not even Nikki Haley. I haven't heard a single Republican hammer on that, and it it's an obvious issue.
They won't do it, but I think perhaps the best example, and Judith would correct me if I'm wrong, but the best example is Texas. Texas has had so many environmental issues over the last several years that's caused deaths, thousands of deaths, whether it's heat or you know, their power network failing them in the middle of a blizzard. And once the emergency has passed, it's back to normal. We're just going to ignore, you know, the big elephant in the room. And one of the other things about the shutdown that we're, I guess, coming back full circle is the fact that funding for FEMA, you know, right now we're in hurricane season where you just don't know where the next fire, the next mudslide is going to come from. And here we are risking people's floods, risking people's lives by underfunding FEMA. And possibly FEMA not having anything to respond should something happen within the 8 days of a shutdown.
And that funding is already being scaled back in anticipation of a government shutdown. Now, I just have to believe, and I could be totally incorrect about this, that there must be more receptivity out there among red state Republicans to the proposition that climate change is not some kind of a fraud, okay, as former President Trump has suggested on numerous occasions, that it's real, that it's affecting our lives, that it's affecting our ability to survive. And I'm just waiting for, you know, one of these candidates at least to try to tap into that issue to see if there's any there.
Yeah, the last Republican who really observed that and spoke out like that was John McCain, and that was years ago. And then he moved a little bit away from it, but he played a really important role in the Republican Party. No one's really replaced him.
It's great American.
Utica Congress member Sherry Bollert was fantastic. He's not in Congress anymore.
Did you say
Bollert? Absolutely. What?
You didn't say Bollert, did you?
Oh, no. Sherwood Bollert, B-O-E-H-L-E-R-T. Oh, no, I would not say her. She's not helpful in any way. But agriculture is really being impacted. These intense storms are hitting Florida, you know, Mississippi, South Carolina. And interestingly, you know, on the flip side, the states with the most wind are Iowa and Texas. And it just, you know, this is not a partisan issue. This is not a political issue. The planet's going to survive, but will we? And that is the question.
We are out of time for this morning. I want to thank you all for being with us. Judith Enck, Fred Hoff, David Soares were our panelists this morning. The panel will be posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Once again, the URL for the Roundtable Mug Design Contest is wamc.org/RT Mug Contest. Our playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. I wonder sometimes how many times I've said wamc.org in my life. It's a lot.